Hello, welcome to another edition of Running Dialogue, a podcast about movies. Our first one since before Christmas, basically. We had took a little vacation, but now two of the three of us are back. I'm Kurt Holman, a film critic with Creative Local Newspaper in Atlanta.
And I'm Matt Goldberg with Collider.com.
And our usual partner, Russ Fisher, is not available today, but promises that he'll be back next time to talk about the Oscars, because he's such a big Oscar fan.
He is. Basically. He loves it. He gets a gushes. Party. He dresses up. Yeah. He's like Truman Capote.
Exactly. This time we thought we would talk a little bit about Valentine's Day movies in a bit, because there's not that much out today. But we would first talk about the new release, which is The Eagle. And one could make a case that it's sort of a Valentine's Day movie, because it's almost more of a bromance than an action film.
Right, but without the brotherhood or the romance or likable characters. I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. Go on.
Do you want to sum up the Eagle?
Sure, I'll go for it. So The Eagle, it's based off the real-life mysterious disappearance of the Roman Ninth Legion. Last year we saw Centurion, which also used the Legion's mysterious disappearance as a launching point for a sword and sandals action flick.
And this is based on a novel written in 1954 for young adult... kind of for young adult readers. I don't know the book that well, but its source goes back to that.
Right. So in this version of this spin on the tale, the protagonist is named Marcus Aquila, and he's played by Channing Tatum. And his father was the commander of the Ninth Legion, and his family's been disgraced because not only did everyone mysteriously disappear and likely die in the Ninth Legion, but they lost their standard, which is a golden eagle. So Marcus feels his whole thing is, I must reclaim my family's honor. He does a great job of that at his first command, where he's leading his men, but he gets injured in battle.
And this is all in Britain.
Northern Britain. Yeah. And so he gets honorably discharged, and he's like, no! And so he decides to go on a man on a mission and go into, enemy territory, essentially, to find the Golden Eagle, and his only guide is a slave whose life he saved, named Eska, and he's played by Jamie Bell. So the two of them basically go through the wilderness, and go through the wilderness, and go through the wilderness, which for what feels like many, 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 many hours, and to find the eagle.
Yeah. Well, one thing I will say is that I really liked the first act of the movie, and when they first kind of when he arrives, one of the first scenes, like, he arrives in England, and there's a scene with these like water buffalo being put through a river, and it feels like Apocalypse Now in the second century almost. And when he gets to this fort, which is his first command, it's very like kind of the universality of the soldiering experience, where there's like a joke, it's like, you might have noticed we're having trouble with the latrines, but we're having someone work on that. And there's a scene where like they're surrounded and they have like some fight scenes and all that that aren't very violent or memorable that way, but are moody and cool. So I dug it. And then they kind of get into the honor stuff and kind of the wary, grudging friendship between the master and the slave stuff. And it just kind of comes tedious, and kind of all the energy goes out of it. And even when they go, past Hadrian's Wall into what's Scotland, and it's like out of the end of the world, it's still not all that exciting or interesting, and especially compared to Centurion, which had its flaws, but was like fast-paced and violent, and you had the sense of this kind of alien, people who we sort of identify with the Russian, with the Romans, in kind of a more alien landscape,
So. Yeah, the Eagle had a tough time hooking me from the start. I do agree that it's stronger in its first act than it is in its latter two, but I still had a tough time because even though there was some cool, cinematography, and I think when the director, Kevin McDonald, when he pulls back, he has a great visual eye, not for fight scenes, he doesn't know how to do that, but when in the calmer moments, he has a great job, photographing that and really setting a mood. Unfortunately, Marcus comes onto the Roman base, and it's a Roman film, and usually what we expect is everyone talks in the proper British accent.
Yeah.
Everyone must talk like this so we know that it's not the same time. Mm-hmm. And then Dennis O'Hare, who plays this soldier under his command, comes up, he's like, we're going, the latrines are sort of this, and he's just talking like a regular guy.
I dug that.
It took me out of the movie so bad.
Yeah,
I can see your coffee waiting for you off screen.
But see, that worked for me, because it was like, these are like real guys and not phony baloney, you know, sandal guy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the thing is like, it's just you want everyone to talk the same. Now, I don't expect them to speak Latin, but I want everyone to sort of be speaking the same dialect. Yeah. You know, we're all Romans now. Again, the Roman Empire stretched far and wide. Yes, it's possible that someone with a different accent would come along, but you know, when you have an American actor like Denis O'Hare, and I swear to God, I bet he's Canadian. As I'm saying, and someone's like, he's Canadian. Yeah. Don't you know that? But you know, his accent, it just doesn't feel like he's really invested in it. And you know, you get this sort of disparate accents throughout the film, and as it goes along, you just sort of almost feel that there's no real strong vision behind
it. I agree with that. I mean, I will say that I think that the idea was kind of like the Romans had more of the American accent, and the Britons or Celts or Picts or whatever they were had more of the English accents to sort of maybe set the dichotomy between them.
Right.
Even though I don't know if that came across.
I think, like, strong. I mean, I think if they had gone like a more Scottish brogue, like you can do like various English accents, but I would have sort of accepted sort of a proper British accent for the Romans, and then sort of a, you know, gruffer tone for the, you know, the native tribes.
Yes. Yeah. Well, one thing, the thing that kind of lost it for me was they go to the wilderness, you know, and they're looking for the tribe that has it, and they discover that the tribe that has the standards are the bloodthirsty seal people. And the movie takes itself pretty seriously, but you can't take the seal, represent the seal people seriously.
I can take it seriously. You know? If I had been invested in the film, I could have taken it seriously.
Yeah.
But I think it's sort of that inattention to detail, like where if you're a director or a writer and you just, and the term seal people, even if it's historically accurate, doesn't work.
You can make...
In Centurion, they're the Picts.
Yeah.
You know, P-I-C-T, they're spelled out in the beginning who they are. It's like, okay, it's a foreign people, I don't need to worry about that. The seal people is like, we live next door to the crab people who taste like crab and talk like people.
We're going to balance our beach balls on our nose and flap our flippers at you. You know,
right, so. Exactly. It's, and it just doesn't feel like there's a lot of, you know, investment in that. Again, I hate to keep making the Centurion comparison, but Centurion, it's like this alien people, like in blue war paint, you know, the savagery to it. Everyone who's just a native tribesman in the Eagle is just, we wear rags.
Well,
we wear furs.
Well, there's like kind of...
And we have kind of our caked-on makeup.
Yeah, yeah.
But even that, like, to me, it's like, that's a missed opportunity. Mm. And to me, it's like, that's just going to clog your pores.
One thing about, like, the action of the movie, I wanted to say, and I don't have that much else to say about it, is that I get the sense that it looks like an R movie that was cut down to a PG-13. Because there's stuff like... some of the Picts or whoever they are, it wasn't the SEAL people at this point, had this like chariot with these big like bladey things sticking out, going like zzz, 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 and you're like, oh my gosh, it's coming this way and it's gonna mess up with them when it gets to them, and that happens, but it cuts away so you don't see like legs flying, kneecaps lopped off. You know, it's just like, ah, something happened, and it cuts away. So it's like, you know, I mean, I don't demand visual blood.
I don't
like,
need it to be as violent as Centurion or as gory, but at the same time, again, it's about investment. And I feel like if this film had been more character-driven and had a greater commitment to its setting and tone, then something like that, it would feel like, oh, they're doing it because it's so gory, it'll leave our imagination to wonder. Which works more in horror films than it does in action films. But it would at least, I would at least see the reasoning before that. But because I'm not engaged, I'm like, oh, so that's how they're getting a PG-13. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
it doesn't really work.
Yeah. So anyway, the Eagle is one of several movies opening this weekend that we, other ones we didn't see, including Just Go With It with Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston, and Romeo and Juliet, which are both arguably like date movies, since theoretically they have romance in them. But if it's like Garden Gnomes and Adam Sandler are your choices, you know.
Have you heard about Redbox?
Yeah.
Have you heard about On Demand? Yeah. Have you heard about millions of other ways to see movies?
Yeah, so we thought we might offer some other choices. And I didn't have a choice. I just blogged about it a few minutes ago. That might be kind of counterintuitive. That is actually still playing. Probably the video picks.
Enter the Void.
But, actually, it's almost as counterintuitive, which is Another Year, the Mike Lee movie, which I'm going to say... and I kind of gave three reasons in support of taking a date to see this. You know, it's this downbeat, disheveled, kind of rambling movie. But kind of the first reason is that it has at the center a happy couple. So if you're in a relationship and you go on a date movie, it's like, hey, here's a good example of something to shoot for with, you know, Jim Broadbent and Ruth Sheen as these, I guess they're in London, who are like, they're these like, been around together and they look kind of, been around each other forever and they look kind of alike almost at this point, and they have the same kind of corny sense of humor and they're cheeky and they're embracing. It's like we should all have someone who we grow old with like them, you know. The second part is kind of more where the tension in the film comes in, which is from their friends who are single and miserable. And basically, you know, it's a good date movie to bring someone you want to commit to you, because otherwise, like, you don't want to be like these single people.
It's a cautionary tale.
Yeah, exactly. Because Leslie Manville plays their friend Mary, who's just this kind of train wreck, bottomless pit of need, who's like drinking and lonely and clingy, and
that's the person you want in a relationship.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but it's like, well, you don't want to end up like this, do you? Is kind of the thing, you know. So and she does a really good job of it, but you get I got kind of tired of the character as the movie went along. But the third reason is that like it's a good movie, you know, and and you won't, even if you're not into like kind of how downbeat it is or plotless it is, just still be impressed by the acting. And in the third act of the movie, or maybe it's the fourth act, there's like a funeral that kind of brings characters together, and a lot of the themes seem to snap into place.
Okay.
And I was really, you know, invested with the last section of the movie. And Imelda Staunton actually has a couple of scenes in it as, like, basically the most depressed woman in Britain in the first part. And it's really good. It's kind of a shame you don't see her again. But so anyway, if you're, maybe if you're not, it's not a good first date movie, but if you're, like, kind of in that, in a relationship or about to be, it might be a better one, you know.
I see. Okay. Yeah, you know, a few weeks ago, we didn't talk about it, but the film, you know, in terms of rom-coms was No Strings Attached.
Mm-hmm.
Did you?
I didn't see No Strings Attached.
Okay, see, I saw No Strings Attached, and I read some of the reviews surrounding it, and one of the comments that struck me was, it turns the genre on its head, because she wants to have sex, but he's all mushy and wants to be in a relationship. Oh my god, it's like, dear god, did this movie come out in the 1950s? And no one told me? Because if that was the case, yes, it would be surprising. And it's just, to me, No Strings Attached highlights how little innovation goes into the rom-com genre. Now, just no one's really thinking it through. It's the most disposable, most formulaic, and in a way, and arguably the most negatively impactful, because it sets up perfect guys and perfect girls we're supposed to want to be with, who have cutesy flaws at best, and nothing really substantive. Now, granted, I don't want, you know, a rom-com to be like, yeah, they're going to get together. He has to beat his crippling heroin addiction.
Yeah.
But after he beats that, you know, I don't need gritty realism.
You want Blue Valentine in your rom-com.
Yeah. Right, right. I don't need that for my comic. I mean, that's a good romance film. It feels very honest. But I don't need that. I understand the need for fluffy rom-coms, but I think they can be much better than they are.
Yeah.
And so a film I wanted to suggest is Down With Love, which came out a few years ago, and it's sort of a parody of the Rock Hudson, Doris Day romance films of the, 50s, 60s?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Ewan McGregor and Renee Zellweger, and he's sort of this Lothario playboy, and she's this girl from the sticks who's, you know, has a new novel called Down With Love, and this self-help book tells women that, you know, they can have sex without love, and if they want to suppress their urges, eat chocolate. But it captures the tone so well. It was directed by Peyton Reed, who also did Bring It On, which is another great movie. And it's just, it has such a light, fluffy tone to it. There's a musical number at the end. And even if you haven't seen the Rock Hudson, Doris Day movies, it's just a delightful movie. And even though at its core, it's a romantic comedy. It is still, you know, girl plays, you know, guy wants girl wants guy.
Yeah.
Guy, they don't know each other, but he plays with it and it understands, like, let's give people something new. Let's give a romantic comedy with something fresh to offer. And I think, and the result is, you know, it's a good movie on its own merits, but it's even better when contrasted against all the other crap.
Well, the thing about rom-coms that drive me nuts is that they, opposed to like a lot of the other genres, is that, like, you know, like action movies or horror movies or whatever. It's like rom-coms have to be like, have to have really well-written dialogue and really be acted well enough to pull it off, you know? Whereas, like, horror movie, action movie, you know, if you have, like, kind of the editing and the cinematography, you know, you can, like, get away with it not being written that well, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it kind of depends upon what you're looking for, you know? But if it's, like, a shopping montage, say, it's got to be... there's got to be something going on for most people to have interest in it beyond just unless you... care about what the clothes are or whatever it is they're buying, you know.
Yeah.
So,
and it seems like the trend, there's becoming a trend where they're saying, rather than let's focus on the quality, mm-hmm. let's get sharper dialogue, let's have more interesting characters, it is a shift to quantity.
Mm-hmm.
So we get, he's just not that into you, with many love stories.
Yeah.
And Valentine's Day, with many love stories, mm-hmm. which are great for studios, because it's like, we're going to pay actor X amount of money mm-hmm. To shoot 2 days worth of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to come on, we're going to get to put his name on the poster, and we'll put a bunch of other known actors mm-hmm. on the poster. And if we throw enough actors on the poster, then people will come out to see it, even if that person is in the film for a grand total of 10 minutes.
It wasn't like Julia Roberts in...
Julia Roberts is in Valentine's Day.
For like less than 10 minutes?
For less than 10 minutes, yes. It is... And see, that's the thing. It can just... it's almost like a cavalcade of cameos at that point.
Yeah.
And it's not about story. It, you know, we're having films struggling just to tell one good rom-com line, and instead they're throwing many bad.
Yeah.
Just like, hey, you like you, if you want one generic rom-com situation, wait for this. We'll give you 7 or 8. And now, of course, they're developing New Year's Eve, which is a sequel of sorts to Valentine's Day.
They'll run out of holidays, you know.
One would hope, and then they'll just invent them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Actually, one movie that, you know, will kind of, I didn't even think of this until just now, but the movie that kind of works as a romance, as a romance, kind of like as a subplot to it, is a Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Because there's so much else going on in it, but the kind of the romance between, you know, Bill Murray and Andy McDowell is kind of like the spine of the movie, almost.
It is, and it's a really interesting way to approach that, because it gets to this really universal thing you don't think about. It's like, man, if, you know, when you approach a woman, or you approach, you know, you're talking to someone, and you want to get it right the first time, and you most likely won't.
Yeah.
You know, but what if you could just keep doing it again and again, and keep, you know, get another chance to keep going back and setting it right, so that first meeting would always be, you know, that first date, rather, would always be the one you hit out of the park.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, it taps into that sort of fantasy aspect of it.
It's also funny how, like, the falling in love thing is not where Groundhog Day stops, and he has to kind of have, like, kind of the perfect day before
it has to be more than just that.
Yeah, and it's almost like in Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, where, you know, he fights with at the end with, like, you know, the sword of true love or whatever, and doesn't win, but then whips up the sword of self-respect, which is the important, more important thing, and does win. So, you know,
right.
I like how both of those say that, you know, love is important, but it's not everything.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, it's, you know, again, I understand that movies are an escape, and that we should want, it would be, you know, we don't want every movie to lecture to us and tell us, you know, love is not everything. We want to believe, at least for 2 hours, that, and even that's running along for a while, that a movie can, you know, will we even believe, yes, love can conquer all. You know, if I just had that, I would be happy. Or if I do have that, that makes me happy. It's, the problem is that the journey to get there just feels so shallow. To the point where, you know, a film like No Strings Attached comes out, and we're getting the same film, basically, in a couple months, or with Friends with Benefits.
Yeah.
Same movie. And it's and all I'm hoping for Friends with Benefits is, like, just be better written.
Yeah.
Just have better jokes. You know, have better characters, because no one wants to mess with the formula at all. And it's just sort of, it's disheartening, and it's why, you know, you and I just can't sit through after a long day, sit through Just Go With It.
Yeah.
We can't sit through Adam Sandler through a contrived shenanigan to pretend he wants to get with Brooklyn Decker, but I bet he's gonna get with Jennifer Aniston.
Yeah, shockingly.
Yeah, because she's more famous.
Yeah. I did want to kind of mention a couple of older movies,
sure.
You know, as part of that, and one is kind of like the screwball comedy is kind of like in a way set. Kind of a standard that the modern rom-coms try and get, but in terms of like kind of the snappy dialogue
right.
and the kind of the battle of the sexes, but it kind of establishes that they're equals and they're meant for each other, even though they're usually
yes.
antagonistic. Two of the classics, which are two of my favorites, are It Happened One Night
okay.
with Clark
yeah.
Gable and Claudette Colbert,
which I would say invented the rom-com.
Yeah, yeah, and it's been basically remade or influenced movies like The Sure Thing with like John Cusack, you know, with like a couple making, you know, a road trip and they're mismatched, but they end up, you know, falling in love, you
right.
know. And but they're like totally charming and Happy One Night has like this wonderful scene where they're like they're riding on a bus cross country and everyone sings the Daring Young Man on the Flying Trapeze, and it's this crazy it's like people actually like on cross country trips in the buses have sing-alongs in the 30s because it seems wonderful, you know. I'm kind of like skeptical, but maybe it was, you know. And, the other one is His Girl Friday with Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell, and it's almost more of a journalism movie. It was based on the script The Front Page, in which actually it's like an editor and his writer who are both men and they don't
right.
have any relationship, you know.
Exactly.
But and this was like Cary Grant's the editor, Rosalind Russell's the writer, and she wants to split and marry Ralph Bellamy, and he basically tricks her into reporting on the story, and they get back together. I think they were estranged or something like that, and they're just like made for each other. So one thing is like it's so funny and so snappy, and they come together so well. So it's, you know, just incredibly satisfying. And the other one I want to mention is a Woody Allen movie because he's so good at this kind of stuff when he was like really on his game. And Annie Hall and Manhattan are two like great films about relationships, but are kind of bittersweet.
Right.
They don't really come together at the end. Anyway, Annie Hall is one of my favorite movies. So I wanted to mention Hannah and Her Sisters, which is more of a group of people movie almost, but there's some like love stories in it as kind of like the central stories, like Diane Wiest and Woody Allen, who have like this sort of disastrous date early on, but end up like getting together by the end. So it's very warm and like, it has this kind of attitude of like reconciliation, embracing life and all its, you know, different aspects and things like that. So it's like, well, why wouldn't you want a movie like that as like a date movie kind of thing, which leaves you feeling good about everything and not just, you know,
right.
let's go and drink wine and have a picnic and throw popcorn at each other or whatever.
Yeah, I'll add a few older movies into there as well. One more recent than the other, but you mentioned His Girl Friday, and I'd like to throw in another screwball Howard Hawks comedy is Bringing Up Baby, which I absolutely just adore. You know, it's, you know, you have this Cary Grant being delightful as always, this researcher, and then here comes Katharine Hepburn in to mess up everything, and just the repartee they have together. A lot of people point to the Philadelphia Story as sort of the stronger film, but I personally prefer the hell out of Bringing Up Baby. I think it's a lot more entertaining.
Yeah.
And then the other film is Chasing Amy, because I think it's an interesting... I think it's easily Kevin Smith's best film.
Oh, yeah.
But I would also say, because it hits an honest part of sort of the difficulty of relationships, but also looking at the cross-section of where, you know, love, needs sex, because this notion of, you know, you have a character wants to separate the two and yet wants it from the same time, and like, how do we define ourselves in terms of sexuality, and, you know, what does that mean in a larger sense? I think it's a really smart film, and he has not come close to a great
one. Yeah. Well, there's a tangent. There's a wonderful scene in Chasing Amy that I always think about, showing people how they do their jobs and things like that. And there's a part where Ben Affleck and Jason Lee are writing their comics together, and one of them says, you know, it's like, this is a great lamppost you've drawn. This is the best you've ever drawn. He says, yeah, it's the one by the post office. And it just kind of goes on. And that just a little bit, you get this sort of sense of, like, the craft they share and how well they know each other and how well they know each other's work and things like that. That's not even
scene.
The romance part, but it's a little kind of throwaway part, but it's like, why can't he do this in all of his movies?
Exactly. Why can't I just have, like, little character moments instead of... people talking on endlessly. Not that there aren't monologues in Chasing Amy, but at least they feel better integrated into the story than his other films. Yeah. So yeah, those are a couple of romance films that I enjoy that aren't recent. But again, if, you know, if you're going out to the video store, you know, we've given you plenty of stuff to check out.
So I guess we should start winding it up. One thing I did want to mention is this weekend in Atlanta, Landmark is showing the Oscar-nominated short films programs. The one is the Oscar-nominated live-action shorts, and the other the animated shorts. And in the animated program, there's a wonderful film called The Lost Thing. It's a computer-animated film. Sean Tan is one of the directors, and it's based on a book by Sean Tan. I can't remember his co-director on it. But it's this lovely story from Australia about a boy who finds this lost thing, which is sort of alive and sort of indescribable, and it's kind of like a cross between E.T. and Terry Gilliam's Brazil, if you can imagine it, with like this kind of boy and his alien story, along with this, like, you know, crazy, junky, ramshackle universe that they're in. And they have like this real warm relationship, but it's also about like growing up and losing the ability to appreciate like the little kind of wonders in life and being focused on other things. So it's very bittersweet, but it's just ingenious. I mean, it's a great movie. It's nothing that I'll be bugging people about all year, because it's like, you know, well, this was good, but The Lost Thing was really awesome. You know,
right. And also, you know, to add to that, of stuff people in Atlanta should go see, on February 17th, Memento will be showing at the Studio Movie Grill on Holcomb Bridge. It'll be a high-definition showing of the film to mark its 10th anniversary, and it'll be accompanied by a taped Q&A between director Christopher Nolan and Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, del Toro asking Nolan about the film, and I don't know if you've ever seen del Toro be interviewed, but the dude is incredibly entertaining. Collider attended the event last week where they spoke live, and it was apparently very fascinating to watch. So if you want to go back to see Memento again, I haven't seen it in a few years, so I'll probably be going. But yeah,
I didn't know about that. That sounds awesome. So, anyway, well, we're at the end, and I want to thank Bobby Feingold for being our producer. He's replacing Alejandro Leal, who has moved on to better things. So so appreciate it, Bobby. And
you,
next time we should be back.
For Collider.com, I'm Matt Goldberg.
And I'm Kurt Holman with CreativeLooking.com. Thanks for listening through to the end.